going to have Tobin later, but first, Gareth Walker insisted on publishing a fascinating article in a very obscure place in some journal that nobody ever reads. So I thought, where better to have it really brought to people who matter than in the C-Data? So we're going to see how people have a variety of ways of representing what is, of course, unrepresenting. And you know what I mean, difficult to represent. But there are interesting varieties in how you would go about doing that. So over to you, Gareth Walker.
Okay, thank you very much. Can you hear okay? Yeah, I hate using microphones. I love to bellow, but I'm trying to resist the temptation to bellow and use a microphone at the same time.
Please do both.
I'll do both, okay. So, as Charles said, what I have to say relates to the visual representations of acoustic data. That's a rather grand title for pictures, and particular kinds of pictures. So, when I talk about visual representations of acoustic data, I mean things like waveforms, pitch traces, spectrograms, intensity traces, basically things that Pratt does. This isn't a lecture about Pratt, but we can do that some other time if you want. So I'm thinking about those sorts of objects. Don't worry if you don't know what any of those things are. Hopefully I'll be able to kind of demystify them, at least to some extent, today. As Charles mentioned, I've published a paper on this in Rawlsy, so there are a few places that you can find out a bit more about the kinds of things that I have to say, partly in Rawlsy. I also did a guest blog on the Rawlsy blog. There are also, yes, absolutely. Yeah. I've also got some scripts available on my website that you can make use of. So these are all things that you can kind of follow up afterwards, ask me about and all that kind of thing. I am going to try to make sure that this talk doesn't simply replicate what's there. So I'll talk about, so that if you have happened to have read that paper, there'll be something a little bit different here as well. So, to start off, we're going to start off with the Mona Lisa. So, for reasons which may not be entirely obvious, but hopefully they'll become clear. I'm going to assume, just for the sake of argument, that this is a reasonable likeness of somebody who actually existed. Okay, whatever cynicism you might have, just put that to one side. Just accept that this is a picture. There's a visual representation. So now you're seeing the connection. A visual representation of a real individual. Now, if we could travel back in time, if we had this visual representation and nothing else, we'd probably feel reasonably confident that we could recognise that individual should we happen to see her walking around in the street. We'd be reasonably confident. At least I'd be reasonably confident, but maybe I'm just a reasonably confident individual, I don't know. So we'd be reasonably confident if we had that visual representation. If, on the other hand, we had that visual representation, we'd feel much less confident for what should be obvious reasons. If we had another kind of visual representation, so if we had this, if we had a line drawing, a beautiful line drawing, very kind of, a very attractive line drawing, if we had that line drawing, we'd probably be less likely than in the previous slide, and certainly even less likely than in the original picture, in the original visual representation. How does this connect then with visual representations of acoustic data? Well, if you think about what you normally experience when you read a journal article and you see that article with a pitch trace in it, a spectrogram, a waveform, and so on, those visual representations are typically the only way you have as a reader to get at the original utterances. You may have bits of description as well, you may have bits of transcription, but just like you might only have the Mona Lisa as a visual representation to assist you in getting at the original person, so identifying that person in the street, the same thing holds for visual representations of acoustic data. That's primarily what we have. Yes, sometimes we have the audio as well, but generally we don't. Even if we do, we might not bother necessarily going back to the original. We go by the pictures that are presented to us. In terms of the aims of this talk, so what I'm trying to do is, first of all, is to encourage some thought about how visual representations of acoustic data are prepared and used. So this is kind of, I suppose this is about consciousness raising, provoking thought, getting you to think more carefully about what you might prepare, if you prepare visual representations, or your students for that matter, prepare visual representations of acoustic data, but also think about the kinds of things that are presented to you in journal articles, conference talks, and so on. Another thing is to give some suggestions on good practice, so as somebody who comes from a primarily linguistics and phonetics background, so give some suggestions on good practice in constructing visual representations of acoustic data. This, of course, isn't a phonetics course, it's about it's a 15-minute talk or something like that, but I can kind of pass on some bits of good practice to you. Just to make it clear at this point, this is about research practice rather than about research findings as such, Okay, so this is about how we go about doing our research. Okay, so why is this important, and possibly why did this kind of stuff get written up and published in Rawlsy? Well, if we look at articles from Rawlsy over the last 10 years or so, what we find is there's a reasonable number of papers that make mention of some kind of technical phonetic detail. So it might be about pitch, it might be about loudness, you know, various different sorts of things. If we look historically, and this has been going on for a while, but if we look over time, what we find is that more and more papers are using visual representations of acoustic data in support, or ideally, I suspect, in support of the claims that the authors have to make. So these visual representations are becoming more common. More often we see pitch traces, spectrograms, and so on. So it seemed to me like quite a good time to think about what kinds of things have we seen in that journal, and also to think about, in some cases, how things might be improved. Just to make it clear at this point, this is not a particular concern of Rawlsy as such. Lots of the points that I make in that paper, some of the points that I make today, could be equally well applied to papers that appear in other journals, Journal of Pragmatics most notably. It just happens that I was looking at Rawlsy, focusing on Rawlsy. So these sorts of visual representations seem to be becoming more common. One paper that includes visual representations, it includes pitch traces and spectrograms in particular, is this paper by Steve Clayman and Chase Raymond. Just to be clear at this point, I think this is a great paper, okay? I don't, and they're not even here. I'm still happy with that. I think this is a great paper. I don't have any particular problem with the claims that they make. I don't even have any particular problem with the phonetic analysis that they do. But I do think that they could have, and I would have said that even if they had been here, I do think that they could have made better use of the visual representations that they had in that paper. And I'll show you why in a moment. So this is one example from the Clayman and Raymond paper. I'm not going to go into details as to exactly what the phenomenon that they're talking about. That really isn't terribly relevant. But we've got an extract here from a telephone call, one of the NB telephone calls, which coincidentally you can actually access the audio for in this case. What they're looking at in this particular instance is what you can see at line 4, so particularly the you know that Emma produces in the middle of, hey, I've been eating a lot of turkey, you know, I don't have one bit of itching. Don't worry about the context for now if you don't know the context. So I'm particularly interested, as they were, in this use of the word you know and how exactly it's produced. It's not produced the way that I just did it in my kind of mimicked version. So this is an extract from their paper. And so the bit on the left-hand side, this bit at the bottom here is a spectrogram. I don't have time to give a big, long account of exactly what spectrograms are. Just to keep it simple, on a spectrogram like this, time runs from left to right, so things that are happening on the right-hand side are happening later in time than things that are happening on the right-hand side. Frequency is shown on the y-axis, so higher frequency things are towards the top, lower frequency things are towards the bottom. This is not the same as what you normally think of as pitch when people speak. Okay, that's about as much detail as I can give about that. At this point, I'm happy to speak more about them in the questions at the end. I can refer you to other things and so on. This is a labelled pitch trace at the top. So all of these dots here correspond to Pratt's estimates of pitch values for that utterance. So that, these are Pratt's guesses. Pratt, incidentally, is very good at guessing at pitch values, but as we'll see, it's not perfect. So where you see dots that are relatively high up, this is something that has relatively high pitch. Where you see dots that are low down in visual representation, like this is relatively low pitch. Okay. So, and you see some labels along the bottom here. This is a quote straight from the Clayman and Raymond paper. As evident in the spectrogram, there is a merging of the final consonant of turkey, so that in a lot of turkey, the final consonant of turkey with the initial consonant of you know across this juncture, so across the join between turkey and you know, with no break in voicing in a single palatal place of articulation. I have a few concerns about what they have to say, but we're going to focus on this bit. So the bit that says no break in voicing, that's the only bit that I'm going to worry about for now. So what they're saying is there's no break in voicing between a lot of turkey and you know I don't have one, so it's continuous. The vocal folds, in other words, dress it up a bit, the vocal folds are vibrating continuously across the joint. I'll play it for you and that'll become much more clear.
A lot of turkey, you know I don't have one. A lot of turkey, you know I don't have one. A lot of turkey, you know I don't have one.
So she says, a lot of turkey, you know I don't have one. She doesn't say, a lot of turkey, you know I have what I don't have one. Okay, so she says, a lot of turkey, you know I don't have one. So she's speaking all of the time. So from the EBIT of turkey, we get turkey, you know. We don't get turkey, you know. You hear the difference between those two things? One has no break in voicing, where you get turkey, you know, and one does have a break in voicing, so the vocal folds stop vibrating. I'll not go into all the technicalities of all that kind of thing. So these are the visual representations that the authors give us in support of that no break in voicing observation. They could have been better in various respects. So they say that this is evident from the spectrogram. Not really. Just to be clear, the conclusion they reach is right, but this isn't the best way to show it. I'll show you a better way to show it in just a moment. Another thing that they don't mention is that the pitch trace, you can see that the dots are continuous over this bit, so the join from turkey to you know, there are dots continuously all the way across that join. Prahd is actually telling us, by giving us those dots all the way across the join, Prahd is telling us that there is no break in voicing. But the authors don't mention this. They could have done this, would help support that claim. Another thing is that waveforms, and I'll show you a waveform in a moment, waveforms are really good at showing continuation of voicing, but Clayman and Raymond don't give us one of those. That would probably have been more useful than either of these two visual representations in terms of supporting their claims. So what would I have looked at as a phonetician? Well, I would have looked at this, had I been looking at the join between turkey and you know. So this is the key bit of turkey and the year bit of you know. If we look at the waveform first of all, the bit at the top, so this is showing us changes in pressure over time. So time's going along the x-axis, change in pressure is on the y-axis. What you can see is that the pattern in the waveform repeats. It goes up and down. I always call this up and downness with my students, and I'm dreading ever seeing that in an exam. We've got regular up and downness in the waveform all the way across that joint. You get up and downness. You get up and downness when the vocal folds vibrate. So when we have voicing. So this waveform's giving us really good, really straightforward evidence that we've got this no break in voicing. If we look at the spectrogram at the bottom, this is a much more zoomed in bit, and I've adjusted the contrast in various ways in comparison to the Clayman and Raymond paper. I've zoomed in a bit, and what you can notice here is you can notice some repeated vertical lines. Actually, if I just point them here, it's a bit easier to see. So we've got a vertical line here going up the spectrogram, and a one next to it, and a one next to it, and a one next to it. So we've got about 20 or 30 or something like that in that red circle section. What's this telling us? This is telling us that there's no break in voicing. You get these lines when the vocal folds are vibrating. So our auditory percept of continuous noise, of this no break in voicing, is shown really nicely in the spectrogram as well as in the waveform, and much more nicely, I would argue, in this than in the version that was in their paper. If I was going to put something in a paper, I might put something in it like this. So rather than what they had with a nice big spectrogram where you can clearly see these vertical lines are what are called striations all the way through the spectrogram corresponding to the vibrations of vocal folds. You can see this up and downiness through the waveform as well. So what gets dressed up as periodicity, if you want to impress your friends, periodicity in the waveform. So this regular up and downiness. So this is all supporting their claims. What it's doing then, as well as providing support for their claim, or kind of my claims, I've sort of taken it over, it's providing support for their claim, but it's also allowing the reader to independently verify that claim. So look at the pictures and work out for themselves, for myself, that indeed is an accurate claim. Just to be clear, their claim is absolutely correct, but I would argue that the visual representations that they used didn't adequately support those claims. That's what I would argue. Okay, we're going to think about pitch traces for the rest of the time. I'm going to think about pitch traces in particular because pitch traces are the most common form of visual representation of acoustic data, certainly in Rolsey, and I guess in journals generally dealing with spontaneous speech. You see lots of pitch traces. I don't think that's a terribly good thing, but that's another session. So I'm going to think about pitch traces and how they might be adequately presented. This is an example from some call home data. We're going to think about one particular example as a way of exemplifying other more general sorts of issues. So I don't have a particular obsession with this example. There is nothing weird about this example. It just kind of gets us into other interesting kind of avenues for discussion. So this is the example here.
Has Kim been here before?
No.
Has Kim been here before?
No.
So B says, has Kim been here before, alongside a bit of overlap, then A says no. It's this bit here then.
No.
the knoll that I'm interested in?
No.
And in particular, how we can go about providing a robust visual representation of this one utterance. Just to be clear again, I'm not particularly interested in this one utterance, it just gets us into other sorts of issues. So interested in the knoll. This is what Prat gives us by default. So this is how Prat reflects the pitch characteristics of that knoll, the knoll that we're just hearing before. Now, one thing that you can notice with that knoll, has a decent-sized pitch fall, falls from just about the middle of the speaker's range to just about the bottom. It's interesting that people can kind of place these things in people's pitch ranges even without hearing anything else. There's lots of experimental work to show that we can do that. We've got a pretty big fall, you know, decent-sized fall, reasonably long the speaker's range. Now, Prat's pitch trace doesn't really reflect that terribly well. It's also wrong, which is a bit of a drawback. It's wrong. The most obvious wrongness comes here where I've got these two dots. Prat, like I said before, Prat guesses at pitch values for utterances. That's all it can do. That's all computers ever can do. Prat's very good at guessing, but for lots of different reasons, sometimes guesses and gets it wrong. We've got these two bits out here that are simply wrong. You get pitch values, or you should have pitch values, where the vocal folds vibrate. That's how we get the pitch of our voice. Okay, so you should only get into those places. If I'd shown a waveform along with this pitch trace, you would have immediately recognised, aside from the fact that these just look a bit weird, being miles away from the others, there isn't the kind of periodicity in the waveform that we associate with vocal fold vibration. So all this up and downiness here, these are the vibrations of the vocal folds, whereas this bit along here is just kind of some little bit of rather inconsequential echo. But Prat has guessed that this is vocal fold vibration. So we've got an error there. We've got something wrong. A waveform would have helped us verify that that was indeed incorrect. The actual pitch itself, so the pitch movement on no, this bit here, doesn't look all that much like what we've just heard, but it is what Prat gives us by default. So you might very well see something like that in an article. In fact, you do. We're going to think about another couple of issues. So I've said a little bit about this kind of hand correction, so removing errors when they occur. We're going to think a bit about what's happening on the y-axis in terms of this visual representation, and two particular issues. Firstly, you can see that this pitch trace is plotted on a linear scale. So everything's kind of equal jumps. So the jump between 0 and 150 is the same as between, visually, between is the same as between 150 and 300, and 300 and 450. So this is a linear scale. It's also not scaled to the speaker's pitch range. I'm going to deal with each of those two things in turn. So first think about linear and non-linear representations, then think about things being scaled or not to speaker's ranges. So first of all, linear. This is a very simple bit of physics and music and things, but this might inform your understanding of things that you might read, things that your students might do, and so on. The basic observation is this. We perceive differences in frequency, or in pitch, better at lower frequencies. So we're better at hearing differences between low-pitched sounds than we are high-pitched sounds. Here's an example of something that will help you understand what this exactly means. A piano. And in particular, we're going to look at some pairs of keys on a piano. The first one starts just below, you don't have to be a piano player to follow any of this by any means. So we're going to start off with the C below middle C, or that key there identified by the arrow. That key on a piano produces a sound with a pitch, or a frequency to be more accurate, of 130, just over 130 hertz. The one next to it has a frequency of 138 and a bit hertz. So there's an 8 hertz difference between those two keys. Okay? Those of you who are musicians will know that these two keys are a semitone apart. I'll come back to that in a bit. So we've got two adjacent keys, 8 hertz apart. If we go up an octave, so if we go the next C, so middle C, that middle C has a frequency of 261 hertz. Okay. The key next to that has a frequency of 277 hertz. So we've got a difference within the first pair of about 8 hertz, and a difference in the second pair of about 16 hertz. Now, crucially, if you heard the notes produced by each pair of keys, the interval between them would sound exactly the same. That's how pianos work. So perceptually, the difference between the two notes in each of these pairs, perceptually is the same, but in terms of frequency, once you start measuring things, we get a twice as big difference between the second pair as we did between the first pair. if we put these on a graph, so we put these, so these lines here represent the frequencies of these two pairs of notes. So we have the one below middle C, then C sharp, middle C, and then C sharp just above that. You can see that the visually, the gap between the notes in the second pair is twice as big as the gap between the notes in the first pair. Well, of course it is, because the frequency difference is twice as big in the second pair than in the first pair. But perceptually, and of course as conversation analysts, we're interested in people's perceptions, not necessarily just kind of rather kind of base mathematical sorts of measures like this. We're interested in the fact that perceptually these things are equivalent, but visually on a picture like this, they're not. Now, overwhelmingly, you see pitch traces plotted on linear scales. You should know by now that that's a bad thing to be doing. What you can do is you can plot them on a non-linear or a logarithmic scale, and Prahl can do this for you, it's not magic. What this does, so we've got the same pair of notes here, so we've got the same pair of, so this is our first pair of notes, this is our second pair of notes. Now notice on this non-linear scale where things are being visually squished as we go up the spectrum, so we've got a tiny gap between 250 and 300, whereas we had a massive gap between 100 and 150, so this is on a non-linear scale. Notice that the vertical distance within each pair is exactly the same in each case, which of course perfectly mimics what happens when we hear these things, that we hear each of these pair of notes being an equal distance apart. So we've got a semitone difference within each pair. So a non-linear scale, like this scale on the left, or a logarithmic scale, makes changes at lower frequencies look relatively big and changes at higher frequencies look relatively little. This, of course, is kind of visually mimics our auditory perception. The fact that we are much better, as was shown with the piano example, we're much better at hearing differences at lower frequencies than we are differences at higher frequencies. So, going back to our no example, the thing that we said had a decent sized fall, even though it looked more or less level on the original picture, we've got the same pitch trace, but now presented on a non-linear or logarithmic scale. We've got a bigger fall now, something that looks visually like a bigger fall, and crucially, looks like we heard it before, that it was a decent sized fall. It wasn't level, it was a decent sized fall. So now we've got something that better visually reflects what we can hear. The old contour used to look like that. So this grey one on here, you can see that it's much flatter. In fact, it falls by half as much as our new nonlinear version. And if we want to give measures in semitones, we've got a fall in pitch of 5.1 semitones. Or five keys on a piano, if you want to think of it that way. So an appreciable difference, and that difference that we could hear before. This still isn't terribly good, this picture. It's getting better, but it's still not terribly good. It's not scaled to the speaker's range. So the vertical position of these dots is only telling us about distance from an arbitrary bottom number and an arbitrary top number. I happen to pick 50 and 500 just because that's what Prahl suggests, but it's often not terribly appropriate. It might be in some cases, but not generally appropriate. Why then would we want to do something else? Well, one other thing that we could do is we could plot a pitch trace relative to the speaker's own pitch range. So rather than just an arbitrary bottom number, an arbitrary top number, we could try to give some indication of where this utterance is within the speaker's own pitch range. A couple of reasons that we might do that. First of all, what's high, or indeed what's low, for one speaker might not be high or low for another. Equally, some pitch values might be physiologically impossible for some speakers, but relatively straightforward for others. We also know, thinking about the interactional side of things, we also know that the placement of talk within a speaker's own pitch range has some kind of interactional relevance. And you can go away and have a look at those things if you wish to see a bit more about that kind of thing. So, a couple more pictures. How am I doing for time? I'm not doing time. 5 minutes? Okay, oh, terrific. I'll slow down with that. I wish I'd known. I wouldn't have gone this fast at the start. Okay, so now we're thinking about how you can go about scaling to a speaker's pitch range. What I mean by this sounds rather grand, but what I mean by this is plotting pitch traces in such a way that they reflect where in a speaker's pitch range those things occur. So is it relatively high for that speaker? Not relatively high just compared to some assumed norm or what Prahl suggests, but high relative to what you'd expect for that speaker or low and so on. This picture here shows you, amongst other things, it shows you visually, it gives you an indication of the pitch ranges of 65 speakers, somewhat randomly selected. These are people whose pitch ranges I've measured over the years for various different sorts of reasons. 65 of them are plotted here. Each vertical line represents the pitch range of one speaker. So we can see that this speaker's pitch range goes from about 150 hertz to about 720 hertz. all the way down at the far end, to somebody whose pitch range goes from about 100 hertz to about 200 hertz. The fact that the first is a female and the second is a male, that's not random, but I don't have time to go into that. What we can see from the picture, showing these 65 speakers' pitch ranges, is that it is indeed the case that what's high or low for one speaker may not be high or low for another. So, for example, our person over here, so this very last line here, when he produces something at around about 180 hertz, this is about the top of his pitch range. Whereas if you were speaker A, or the very first speaker here, that would be right at the bottom of your pitch range. So clearly, I mean, one important practical implication of this is that plotting everything, all pitch traces on the same scale, is generally a pretty daft thing to do. Sometimes it might be appropriate, but in general, it's a pretty daft thing to be doing. So what's high for one speaker or low may not be high or low for another. We can also see that some speakers seem to have huge ranges and some speakers seem to have very small ranges. We can also see that women look like they have wider pitch ranges than men, based on these data. The second and third points I'm going to come back to, because it turns out that these aren't straightforwardly the case. Here's the same pitch range data plotted in a different way. So here, range is being plotted in semitones rather than in raw measures of frequency. Now, the semitone scale, I'm certainly not going to go into the maths of it, partly because I'm not the person to go into the maths about it, but the semitone scale is a non-linear scale. So the semitone scale squishes things at higher frequencies and expands them at lower frequencies. Please accept that that's the case for now. So this is the same data as we had before, but plotted in semitones relative to the speaker's baseline. So we can see that somebody has a pitch range of about 35 semitones, all the way down to somebody who has a pitch range of about 10 semitones. What we can see now is that men and women are mixed, so the red and blue lines are kind of interwoven in a way that they weren't before. We can also see that the ranges look more similar than they did before. So the people who look like they had the huge big ranges on the previous slide were the people who tended to have the highest pitch voices. So in perceptual terms, actually, their range isn't quite so great because their frequency changes are happening at higher frequencies where we're less able to perceive those differences. So people are a bit more similar on this picture than they were on the previous slide. So in terms of kind of practical things, these sorts of variations in pitch heights and pitch ranges, so some people have relatively wide ranges, some people have relatively narrow ranges, some people have high pitch voices, some people have low pitch voices, means that it's often worth drawing pitch traces relative to the speaker's own range. When I say often, I mean always. my first version had always it. It's not always worth it. It really is often. I'll go so far as to say usually. I mean, I guess the key point is that think seriously about whether the visual representation you're planning on using really is the most appropriate thing to be doing. It really is often, usually, the case that you want to be drawing things relative to the speaker's own range. Well, if we do that for our speaker that we had before, producing no, that we said had a decent-sized fault, reasonably low in the speaker's range.
No.
So that now looks like this. If you want to know how I went about calculating the speaker's pitch range, I made it up. No, I didn't. If you have a look at the paper in Rawlsey, I talk about different methods for calculating speaker's pitch ranges. There are different ways that you would go about doing this. So now we've got something that visually much better reflects that initial auditory impression of a decent-sized fold, a reasonably low in the speaker's range. When I went and looked at what his pitch range was, we ended up with this. You could, of course, embellish a picture like this with something like this, so you could put a scale on the side to show pitch change in semitones. So you can see here, I said before that this pitch drop measures about 5 semitones. You can see that now with this axis over here. This would be really good if you wanted to compare productions of the word no, or any other utterance for that matter, across speakers. This is a really good way of seeing how people are producing them in their own range, and you can do comparative measures because you've got semitone differences, so this takes into account the fact that somebody might have a relatively high pitch voice, somebody might have a relatively low pitch voice. Yes, I've only got about 30 more seconds here. So this here is how I would probably, depending on what I was trying to show, how I would probably go about showing this in print. So if I was trying to say something about the pitch characteristics of this particular utterance, I'd probably go something like that. Really rather better in several different respects from the first one that we had. And when I say rather better, what I mean is it better reflects what we hear when that speaker produces that particular utterance. So to sum up then, what I've been trying to do is trying to share some advice on preparing robust visual representations. trying to prompt more careful thought, so not just slapping it in because Prat does it, trying to prompt more careful, not that anybody would do that, trying to prompt more careful thought about how visual representations are prepared and used, so whether it's you or you using them or you reading about other people's, and then so be it. And remember, if you don't remember anything else from this rather short 20 minutes, remember that the visual representations, perhaps along with the descriptions and the transcriptions, are how readers usually get at the data. So something, a visual representation that is some way inadequate, some way misleading, is clearly a thing to be avoided. And that's it.
Thank you. Excellent. So time for one or two questions, observation, comments, and confessions for anybody who's abused her or his journal by the wrong visual representation. Very cool.
It was as soon as you used the word confession, it all went wrong.
You're available for private confessions later in the
yes.
Please
we'll
set up that
stuff. Just to be clear, I've transgressed most of these things at several points in my career.
That gives everybody else a license to agree. And me too.
Yes.
I'm being insipidly probed and prodded over here. Ruth F. Barry.
Okay. It's just a comment really, but it did make me think about this has helped me reflect on some of the questions one has in transcribing just the kind of standard Jeffersonian transcription, where you've got somebody who's consistently speaking at a really high pitch, and you don't mark it all the way through, and there seems a bit of an analogue with that, or similarly with accents that you may only transcribe a word sounding weird because it sounds weird for them,
yeah.
As opposed to, when I hear a Geordie as a Mancunian, it sounds weird all the way through. You know? But it's useful for reflecting on, reflecting more broadly, I think, on, what we do mark out and what we don't, and how we represent it compared to the rest of what's going
Absolutely.
On. As it were.
And I think in general that there seems to be a sense that if a piece of computer software, unlike transcription where you get a lot of reflection, if a bit of computer software produces something,
yeah.
then stick it in, it's fine. The computer did it.
It's a bit like if Gale did
so,
it as well.
Well, yes, people adopt things in some cases without question. To go back to the picturing point, yes,
yeah.
I mean, of course, what the raw values don't matter. So if I speak with my son, if we do a bit of pitch matching, it's to do with where it is in my range and where my son's 9, by the way. So it's where it is in my range and where it is in his range. It's not that I'm trying to match his actual, the speed at which he vibrates his vocal folds, because if I did that, it would sound like I was taking the mickey.
Yeah.
I mean, it really would.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
A quick one from you, Andrew.
So if we're interested in perception, which is what we are, and we
yeah.
can all perceive things, how far should we be away from people who are in charge of journals saying, let's start putting in embedded sound files with clickable links so that we can hear it for ourselves?
I've thought for some while, I wasn't intending airing this thought, but I will, because I think it's relevant. I've thought for some while, and the fact that I'm a phonetician, I think, is absolutely relevant, that we don't need the transcriptions in the online, online versions.
Anymore.
Have the sound files.
Yeah.
I mean, I know there's ethical issues, and I know that from a practical point of view, seeing the transcriptions give you something to refer to and so on. But if you only had the audio, you would be required to listen to it in order to make sense of the paper.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that would be a good
mm-hmm.
thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, certainly from the visual representations point of view, this isn't as a substitute for listening to the audio, but it's just as the closest you can get to giving some kind of objective support for what's contained in the sound files. So it's something I would support. But I suspect the question is more for Charles.
Okay, well, thanks once again, Gareth.